The discussion, debates, social media back and forth about the shooting death by an ICE officer of Renee and Nicole Good have gone in quite a few directions, have they not? And that's because people are looking at the tragedy through politics, for example, judgment, certainly emotions. Ultimately, it's only the law and the courts that will determine facts, guilt, and innocence. Our first guest today joins us to examine the laws which will have the final say on what transpired along with the aftermath. He's a law professor at the University of Minnesota, Professor Emmanuel Mollion. How are you today, Professor?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here to clarify again. When we have the law and a legal system in place, when emotion overtakes things, then that's the intent of the law sort of gets lost. By the way, for to learn more about the University of Minnesota, it's umn.edu. I want to start with a very brief reading of the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, because that seems to be, at least at this stage, the foundation of where things are going to progress legally. And the Fourth Amendment, for you listening, reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and efforts against unreasonable," that's a key word, "searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." Again, a short collection of words. What's the significance in this case of the shooting that's taken place and the death of Renee Nicole Good?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, the Fourth Amendment protects and in fact uses the word secures the people against the government from unreasonable searches and seizures. Here, the critical term is a seizure. The use of deadly force against a person has been classified as a seizure by the Supreme Court. And so any use of force, whether it be deadly, whether it be the application of handcuffs or anything in between, must be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And this is determined not only based on the evidentiary burden for a particular interaction, whether that be reasonable suspicion or probable cause, but also the degree of force necessary to effectuate compliance for a specific act. This has been outlined by the Supreme Court as dealing with many different factors. So, for example, the severity of the crime at issue, whether a person is armed and dangerous, whether there is an imminent threat of serious bodily harm or injury to an officer or others, and things of that nature, including whether the person is fleeing or evading arrest. And so if this case becomes prosecuted and goes to trial, and that's a very big if at this point, that is the standard under which the decision to shoot and kill Renee Good would be evaluated.
I was looking at the federal laws that specifically the federal agents have to operate under in sections that detail use of force, and they're a bit lengthy, but just to paraphrase here, basically, if you're threatened as a federal agent, you have the right to respond to stop the threat. But again, superficially watching the video, I don't have the high-tech equipment to analyze a video. What if what happened was a result of you placing yourself in that threatening position? Does that still apply?
Right. Well, this becomes complicated, and it becomes the complicated factual question. Certainly, it lessens your ability to claim that the use of force was necessary if you put yourself into that position. We have to recall, however, that officers, whether they be municipal, state, or federal law enforcement, have different restrictions on their abilities to use force than the rest of us. So for the rest of us, for example, if we engaged in the type of killing that we saw on the video, we'd have less recourse available. We'd have to claim self-defense. You'd have to meet the elements of self-defense. At least in Minnesota, one of those elements is that you are not the aggressor, that you're not initiating contact. Another element is that you attempt to evade before using deadly force. Both of those things would seem to suggest that this was, wouldn't fall under Minnesota self-defense. But like I said, we don't expect officers to have a duty to run, a duty to flee. They don't have that under the Fourth Amendment. And we also, the courts have been fairly deferential for officers when they claim that they are in danger, even if they've put themselves in that precarious position. Courts tend to not want to second guess the decisions, the split second decisions of individual officers in the field. And so, although the standard is, you know, what would an objectively reasonable officer do in this circumstance, and was the force reasonable under that method, courts are really loath to second guess the rapid decision making of an officer. That's all to say that the standard is incredibly deferential to officers. It's incredibly difficult to prosecute and convict under these cases. And even still, I think that this case is one in which that is, it's not entirely clear which way, you know, a court of law or a jury would go. And I think that that tells you something about perhaps the egregious nature of this case, and certainly the value of having video evidence to evaluate it versus the statement of just the law enforcement officers on the scene.
Talking to Professor Emmanuel Mollione, who is a law professor at the University of Minnesota, umn.edu, the website, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. Hasn't the Supreme Court ruled that you can't look at one specific point of time within the event? You have to look at the event, the action, the reaction. You have to look at the totality of what happened. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so the totality of the circumstances includes, like you said, all of the factual information. It includes the severity of the crime. It includes if the officer, you know, if an objectively reasonable officer would believe that they were in imminent threat of serious bodily harm, them or somebody else, and also if the suspect was fleeing. All of these things create the totality of the circumstances. The totality of the circumstances is just to suggest that there's not one determinant factor that is going to tip the scale one way or the other. You have to balance the inquiry overall. And so you're correct. You have to look at who initiated, what was going on. Was Ms. Good posing a threat before the shooting? Was she being, you know, pursued for a crime? Whereas the Supreme Court case, Tennessee v. Gardner, where which sets out the standard for use of force against somebody that's fleeing, and it suggests that you can't use deadly force on someone that's fleeing unless they're posing an imminent threat. That was still a case where somebody committed a serious crime. Courts are going to be less deferential when the officers are initiating contact where there's not evidence of a crime. Now, of course, the federal officers and DHS have indicated that they do believe a crime was underway. In fact, they suggest that there was domestic terrorism, which I think is hard to suggest, you know, at least from my evaluation. But they suggest that a crime was underway in impeding immigration officers from performing their federal duties, which is itself a crime. So, again, it would be, you know, there are complicated constitutional questions here, complicated factual questions. But certainly, I think from the video and everything we've seen reported, there would be enough to bring charges, you know, so long as there was access to the evidence.
And looking at the totality, that would bring into play, too, what turned out to be Ms. Good's final words. "We're okay, dude. I'm not mad at you." And she was smiling at the guy.
Yeah, certainly that's something that a jury would be able to evaluate in that totality.
Another word that comes into play through the Fourth Amendment, as far as what we've been hearing in the debate, and it comes into play, too, with the various laws that we're referencing here, the concept of a reasonable. I saw where back in May of last year, the Supreme Court did issue a decision in the case Barnes v. Felix, because I guess the lower courts, there wasn't any kind of consistency in the what was being ruled as reasonable and unreasonable. Did that ruling in Barnes v. Felix by the Supreme Court help solidify and even better educate so that law enforcement can go back and restudy what their training, what their rules are, to make sure that there's a full understanding of reasonable versus unreasonable?
Well, I would say that there tends to be a disconnect between how the court conceptualizes of, you know, putting officers on notice about what is reasonable or unreasonable conduct, and what actually occurs in the field with training. So there's some ways in which the court will say, you know, an officer was not on notice that conducting, you know, shooting into a vehicle in this manner would have been a constitutional violation, would have been unreasonable. And the court can say it is unreasonable, but because under the doctrine of qualified immunity, because they weren't on fair notice, essentially, then they're entitled to immunity from a civil suit. One of the things that that structure would seem to suggest is that officers are apprised of developments in constitutional law as it develops and have continuous training on the use of force. But something a former colleague of mine, Joanna Schwartz, has shown to a great extent is that that feedback loop simply doesn't exist. Officers tend to get their initial training at the academy, which distills some use of force general principles, but they certainly aren't apprised. They're not lawyers, and their job is not meant to be lawyers and to, you know, the ins and outs of all of the constitutional law developing around the use of force. So to the extent that that is stated as a reason why officers should be off the hook, it suggests that there's a feedback loop that isn't actually implemented into their training and knowledge of the law.
And even when there is training, because we're seeing the training for ICE agents has been reduced from 6 months to, it's an odd number, I know, but it's 47 days, and that number wasn't picked arbitrarily. Someone within the decision process picked that number because Donald Trump is the 47th president, so that gives you kind of a clue what we're working with here. A lot still to be determined, a lot still to be discovered, a lot still to be adjudicated, and that's the key word. And it's not trial by social media, it's trial by court and law. And I think that's the important part to remember in all this. We've been joined by a law professor at the University of Minnesota, their website, umn.edu, Professor Emmanuel Malion. Professor, thank you for the education. Help us better understand how we need to prioritize law over emotion. Certainly have sympathy, empathy, anger, that we're human beings, that we can't help. But we have to put the law on top first because that's what we're built on in this country. Thanks for being here today.
All right. Thank you so much.